Welcome back to Ubuntu Podcast. This is Season 12, Episode 4. Today we're going to disagree with each other, decide we're all wrong but one of us is right in our debate about advocating for the Linux desktop. We've got some command line love and your listener feedback. And joining me to chew over all of that is Alan.
Hello, hello, how are you?
Good evening, very well, thank you. And Mark.
Hello.
Are you well?
Not bad.
Have you recovered from last week?
Somewhat.
Excellent. I'm pleased to hear it. Alan, what have you been up to?
I have been playing with a new Linux distribution. Well, new to me anyway. After Mark had talked about using a Raspberry Pi as an appliance for playing video on his TV, I started looking around at other appliances. And I was watching a YouTube video, and this guy mentioned repurposing a laptop as a gaming system using a Linux distro. I thought, oh, this will be interesting. I wonder what Linux distro he's going to use to do his retro gaming on. And he was using something called Batocera, if that's how you pronounce
it. What now?
Yeah, I know, right? B-A-T-O-C-E-R-A. Batocera or Batocera. I don't know.
Wow.
It sounds foreign. But the interesting thing about it is you download an image and you chuck it on a USB key and you boot off it, and it boots straight into Emulation Station with all the emulators all set up, and all you got to do is put the ROMs and the images on there, and you're basically done. You could just run it off of a USB stick. It also has an option to install it onto the internal hard drive, so it'll wipe whatever's on the internal hard drive if it's got a network connection. And it's just really, really a nice way to have like an appliance on a USB key or on a laptop. He was using a laptop, an old Compaq, I think, laptop he bought off of,
Compaq. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Off of eBay. Might have been Compaq. I can't remember, but it was something old and crusty. And I thought, oh, I've got old crusty laptops lying around. I could use this.
Yeah. Retro laptop for retro games. How meta.
Yes. I put it on the X61S, and it had choppy audio, and I've put a support ticket in, like on their support forums, to try and debug that. But I've also got it on the X220, and I get no audio on that. So I've not had 100% success with this, but I like Emulation Station on the Pi, but this enables you to run it on an X86 machine, which is much, much faster than a Pi.
Right.
So yeah, it's really cool.
I've got questions about this.
Yeah.
So does it run on PC and the Raspberry Pi, or just on PC?
Yep, they've got images for the Pi. Yep, they've got a 32-bit x86 image and a 64-bit x86 image.
And is its objective to be similar to, the same as RetroPie?
Yes, you could say that, but without all the command line-y stuff. It just boots straight into Emulation Station.
Right.
And it's all pre-configured for everything. You just plug a USB controller in and you're done. Like, literally all I did.
Is Emulation Station what RetroPie uses?
Yes, the front end thing.
Right.
The graphical thing where you slide left and right to see each console and scroll up and down through the things. That's Emulation Station. And RetroPie is like the underpinnings that does all the updates and goes and does loads of other stuff. But the nice thing about this is it's a homegrown Linux distro. It's not based on anything else.
This was my next question. Okay, so I was going to say, is it based on Debian or Ubuntu? But this is a whole cloth implementation.
Yep.
Wow. You don't come across many of them, do you?
No.
How fabulous.
It's really nicely done. It's really nicely done. I would highly recommend people try it out if they're interested in turning an old laptop into something just for games. Like, you know, you just want to turn it on and have a screen. Because one of the problems with the Raspberry Pi is you've got to have all the cabling and plug it into a telly and have a keyboard plugged into it. Whereas with a laptop, an old laptop, it's got a screen and a keyboard already. And all you got to do is plug it in and plug a joystick in. You're done.
Laptop and a controller in your backpack. That's you're set to go, really, aren't you?
Totally.
Brilliant.
And because it's on a USB key, you can take it with you. You can just go to a friend's house with a USB key and a controller and use their PC.
Even better. Well, that sounds like a good find. Nice one. Let's move on. So, I posed a question to Mark and Alan, which is broadly this. should we bother at a personal level advocating for people to switch to Linux on the desktop?
Go on, you start and we'll argue with you.
Okay, all right then, that sounds like normal. So my position is we shouldn't bother, that people who are going to find Linux will find Linux without the likes of us trying to tell them about it. Trying to advocate for the Linux desktop to people that are regular, you know, home computer users that don't know what Linux is, I think we run the risk of doing them a disservice where, yes, it's easy for them to do their browsing and their email, but then when that day comes around when they buy a new printer, it all unravels pretty quickly.
Okay. Well, I broadly agree with you. When I was a bit younger and more idealistic, I did occasionally try and tell people that I thought they should use Linux and that it would be really cool for them if they use Linux. But very quickly, I realized that actually, I don't really care what everyone else uses.
Right.
From my point of view, I kind of use what's best for me.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as everyone else is happy, then, most of the time, other people using it won't make it better for me.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's kind of a privileged position for myself, that I'm, you know, it doesn't need to be the market leader and be supported on. I think actually a lot of what I enjoy is getting things to work that were never designed to work that way in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that comes down to my preference. But also with open source more generally, as a developer, I never try and encourage people to do open source development, because I think that once you get to a certain level of development, that's the way you're going to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't feel the need to advocate that kind of thing, because it seems like that's just the obvious solution that people will come to eventually.
Yes. Yeah. And I'd deliberately sort of ruled out developers here because, as you say, I think that, you know, Linux is now the lingua franca platform that everyone is targeting and building on top of in the main, and open source is the way to do that development work. Go on then, Alan. I can hear you've got thoughts.
So I'm in a mixed mind about this, because, you know, I work for a company that make a Linux distribution, and mm-hmm. you know, I really should advocate for the use of the product, which I do, and, you know, I try and promote Ubuntu wherever possible. But sometimes you have to pick your battles, and I think there are some people for whom desktop Linux doesn't work well, and if it doesn't work well, we shouldn't argue with those people and say you should be using this and you are wrong to be using Windows and you're a filthy Windows user and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it might be okay as banter and a bit of fun between friends, but I feel that kind of pushes people away. But I don't know, part of me thinks we should be, you know, this should be a thing we do, because none of the big Linux desktop brands have much in the way of marketing behind them. You never see adverts on the TV or in the paper for any Linux desktop. You see Apple adverts talking about the new products that they sell, and you see Microsoft adverts for, you know, improvements in Windows 10 or what you can do with a Surface Book and stuff like that, because they're selling physical hardware. Mm-hmm. But for the desktop OS, we don't really have anyone doing that marketing. And I know a lot of the time over the years, people have said to us, you should do TV adverts. That's the one thing stopping Linux, is you should do TV adverts, as if that would suddenly make, you know, Adobe Premiere and all their products work on Linux, is a TV advert getting lots of people seeing it.
Well, thinking about advertising that I've seen, Windows is the only, never mind desktop OS, Windows is the only OS that I've ever seen advertised in any kind of meaningful way. I mean, Apple doesn't really advertise Mac OS. It advertises its products, and you never see, maybe in the early days you saw adverts for iOS, but never really for Android. You saw adverts for the apps on iOS, but that, it's not like people ever market the OS as the selling point of their thing. They market the device.
Mm.
Well, no, fairly recently, within the last 2 years, there's been advertising for Android, like specifically marketing around the idea of everyone can be the same running Android, but everyone can be different because you've all got a different Android device.
Oh, okay.
So they were spinning the whole fragmentation thing as a positive thing.
Fragmentation is a good thing, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So they, and I certainly saw quite an annoying amount of TV advertising for Android, and it used the Andrew WK song. I can't remember what it's called. Party Hard, I think.
Yeah.
They use that in one of their advertising. So it was memorable enough that it sat in my head. But the part of the problem with advocating for Linux is you become the go-to support person.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you're doing it small scale, like, you know, talking to friends and telling friends that they should use Linux, and here's the Linux that I would recommend you use. Here's a USB key with it on. Now, bye. You know, they're going to come to you when there's a problem. Just like if you're the guy who knows about Windows and they have a problem with their Windows machine, or you're the guy who knows about a Mac and they've got a Mac machine, they're going to go to you. And it, I guess it depends if you've got the time and energy to be able to do that.
Mm. That has been one of the things that's made me more resistant to it. Like recently, my father-in-law was looking to buy a new laptop. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, this, there's nothing that he needs to do which he couldn't do on Ubuntu. So maybe I'll suggest it to him. And I gave him a USB key with it on and, you know, let him take a look. And he thought it was interesting. But I didn't want to push him too hard because I, you know, I don't want to necessarily be his frontline support.
So having said, you know, I don't think that we should be advocating at a personal level. I do, but strictly within the strictly within the confines of my sort of immediate family, who I've helped move to Linux and stay on Linux for 15 or so years now, maybe a bit longer actually. And I feel like that is scalable to me being able to help and assist them. But I'm not sure that there are some people out there that sort of go around with a badge. You know, they chalk up, I've switched another person to Linux. I've switched another person to Linux. And I wonder how effective that is, how sticky those people that you've, you know, rapidly moved over to Linux is. And also whether it actually adds anything to the sort of long-term user community of Linux users on the desktop.
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, you're a different animal, though. Like, you supporting, like, 10 or so family members, or however many people it is, you're a very different animal than someone who is an enthusiastic user advocate, who knows where to get to Ask Ubuntu and which IRC channel to ask questions on your behalf, your family member's behalf. But you're the kind of person who can answer those questions and maybe even write code or apply patches in the right way and affect the distro they're using very directly. You're in a very unique position. It's a bit different for you. But that said, the point you made about drive-by switching people, yeah, I feel there are people out there who feel it's a badge of honor to switch people. But and I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, because it's a proof of work. And people like to have a proof of work. And it may be, you never know, that the person that was switched, maybe not even directly, maybe their son or their daughter sees this thing and starts playing with it, and they could be the next contributor to your project or another open source project. So, you know, we all win.
Yeah.
It's hard to know. You know, it's very difficult to tell whether helping this rando guy get Linux on his machine is going to result in just him being able to browse the web safer, or is he going to be, you know, creating the next desktop application, or is he creating the next community around a thing that is new?
So I'm increasingly, this is very strange, because I came from a very idealistic position, you know, years ago, and my opinion has changed over time in that it's more aligned with what Mark said, in that desktop Linux suits me, and I really don't care if other people are using it or not. Although I caveat that with, I care about other developers using it. And we do see this increasingly now, you know, Linux being used by developers on the desktop.
Tell us about the Stack Exchange developer survey.
That recently showed that there's 25% of developers using a Linux desktop. And I think that's fantastic because we see then software coming to Linux to meet that audience of users. And by and large, it's developer tooling, but then you see some of the broadly categorized as entertainment applications coming along as well, because, you know, developers also want to listen to music and watch films and play games.
Yeah.
And I feel like that audience is good enough for us to have as desktop Linux users in order to provide enough of a user base to make it a worthwhile target for the likes of Adobe to bring their Creative Suite over, for example.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think we constantly get beaten with the, you know, you're under 1%. You represent less than 1% of the market. Therefore, you'll get less than 1% of my time as a developer. And I agree with you that I don't care what somebody else runs. Like if someone says to me, I run Arch, I'm like, oh, okay, there isn't a shrug emoji like big enough for me to shrug in response to that. If that comes along with, here's the reason why I don't run Ubuntu and there's something actionable in that, then fair enough. If it was the alt tab behavior is demented, then I might say, well, have you tried 1904? But if they, you know, if there's something actually like that's a bug that we could fix that users are experiencing, sure. But if it's just, I don't like it, or I don't like the workflow, or I don't like GNOME desktop, or I don't like Canonical, whatever it is, fair enough. You know, just the same as my friend drives a BMW. I don't care. Like, he can drive a BMW. I don't drive one. And it doesn't make any difference to me which car he drives, unless he's giving me a lift somewhere, in which case, thanks very much. But, you know, largely for the individual, I agree with you, I don't care. But en masse, I think it is critical that we have at least a certain size because it carries weight. And we will be able to go to manufacturers and say, you should make drivers for this piece of hardware because there are these thousands of people who would like to buy it and they can't. Mm-hmm. Or you as a developer should target this operating system because there are thousands of users who would like to use your software. And you can't do that if everyone has said, nah, thanks, I'm going to go and buy a Mac, or nah, I'll just stick with Windows. Thanks very much.
Okay. But is there any value from that point of view in, you know, personal you, me and Martin chatting to people in the pub and trying to convince them to switch to Linux? Or is it that, you know, there needs to be something in the product that is going to draw people in, and regardless of our sort of talking about it to people, we're not what's going to make that shift from 1% to 5%. We, you know, there has to be something in the market that's going to do that.
Right. And I think the grassroots helps, certainly, but it does need like significant shift to get people to move. Like, not many people ran desktop Linux before Ubuntu came along. Yeah, okay, all the haters can email in and tell me how fabulous Mandrake was back in the day and how loads of people ran SUSE back in the day before this upstart Ubuntu came along. But Ubuntu became very much a face of Linux, rightly or wrongly, whether you like that or not is irrelevant. And it helped increase the adoption. It didn't get over that hump, the early adopter, and cross the chasm so that loads of people are using it. There are certainly millions of people using it, and it's well known that it's more popular in the cloud than it is on the desktop. But I don't know that until a certain number of things happen that we'll ever get to that 5%. And I think it helps doing our grassroots, but I don't know that we will, as individuals, be able to get it over that 5%. No, I agree with you.
In recent months, we've seen Proton come along and the advent of Play Your Windows Games via Steam are almost, you know, effort free. Do you see that as the vehicle by which those people that do switch people to Linux will be able to garner more support and more people coming to Linux?
No, that's just one thing. It's like, you know, that conversation we always have when someone tells you, I don't run Linux because X. If only Linux would do X, whatever X is, like run Adobe Creative Suite or run iMovie, or, you know, if it could run this thing, I would switch tomorrow. And your standard answer and my now standard answer is no, you wouldn't, because it's not that one thing. And even if that one person does switch, that's one person, right? There's still millions of other people who won't switch because of a myriad reasons, like even like applications because for managing stuff. No, I think there's just too many things that still don't work.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we've got the basic covered. Like, you can open a browser. Like, anyone could do that. And you could open an email client. Okay. Nobody uses email anymore, but okay. But there's so many other, like, little nitty bits and pieces. Like, oh, I can't connect to my company VPN, or, oh, I've got this piece of hardware that's esoteric and I have to use Windows to talk to that. And, you know, there's so many of those. I don't think it's one thing like Proton. I think there's just so many that you have to slowly chip away at. And yes, it's great that Steam is now on Linux. Yes, it's great that Proton allows you to run Windows games on Linux. But that's just one of many little tiny stones that make a big wall. It's a lot to chip away at.
Well, I think we're going to have to conclude our discussion there, but I would be interested to hear from our listeners. What do you think? Do you think we should be advocating for people to switch to Linux on the desktop? Do you still go to Lugs? Are they still doing this? Do they still exist? Let us know.
If you love the command line as much as we do, send us a command that will blow our minds, and we might even mention it on the show. Send your command line love to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
And now it is time for some command line love. And Alan, I believe you have something lovely for us this week.
I did, and you gave it to me, so thank you. No, not like that. It's the tree command, which you may have heard of. You just type tree and you get a hierarchical output of all the files and folders beneath the directory you're currently sat in. And that's cool and everything, but there's an extra feature that Tree has that allows it to output in HTML format, which is really quite cool if you have, for example, a web server full of files and you want to create an index.html of all those files. And so you can use Tree with a bunch of parameters, which we will put in the show notes, and just redirect the output to index.html. You could do that on a regular basis on a web server, and it just generates an index of all the files in that directory. It's really quite handy.
And that's it.
Did you know you can come and chat with us and other listeners in between shows? Come and join us in our Telegram group at ubuntupodcast.org/telegram.
And now it's time for all your wonderful feedback. Achilles Pipinellis emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
In the last podcast, you discussed about a Raspberry Pi Kodi setup and how that would pass the spousal acceptance factor. I have a solution for you regarding the remote, and they sent us a link to an OSMC remote in their store. It's plug and play, and I've been using this for 2 years. Other than that, you might also be able to set up an existing IR remote control using LIRC.
Yes.
Very helpful, that.
Yeah, I did mention infrared remote controls, I think, last week. And actually, I was rummaging around in my cupboard and I found one still wrapped up in the cellophane wrapping that it came in. So I'm going to dig out my Raspberry Pi, open a LEC, and try it.
Cool. Yes. Another thing I saw, some people were asking me about the one I was using. I was looking on the shop for the ReTech remotes who made the one I bought. And they do actually have one like the Boxy Box remote.
Ooh.
Where it's like an arrows and enter on the front, and then you flip it over, it's got a full keyboard on the back.
Oh,
these are all great, great solutions. Someone else, anonymous apparently, posted a comment on our website.
In your Season 12, Episode 1 podcast, some of you were discussing using XFS and only using EXT4 to make Dropbox happy. This statement and the fact I just finished installing Ubuntu 18.10 brought a question to my mind. Who decides on the default settings of things? For example, use XFS, yet the default for an Ubuntu install is EXT4. Why is that? The default configuration of Pulse makes my speakers sound like a tin can underwater. After Googling, I found some settings that greatly improve the sound quality. Why are the default Pulse settings configured so poorly? I feel these questions are interlinked. It seems that the experts know how to modify their default settings to make their Linux desktop experience as best as possible, while the rest of us non-experts have to suffer through with the defaults, sometimes not knowing there's a better way. Why doesn't Ubuntu provide more sane or optimized default settings? That is a great question. And you could argue that if Pulse default settings makes it sound like a tin can, that's a bug. It shouldn't. The default settings should be right and should be optimal. Unfortunately, sometimes compromises have to be made for things like, for example, power management. It could be that, I'm not saying in this particular case this is the case, but sometimes we tweak a setting in one direction for caution, but that means we use more power, for example, or we turn a knob in the other direction and it uses less power, but it means audio, you know, quality is compromised and you've got to strike a good balance in between. If our default setting is bad, then there should be a bug filed and we should be aware of it, and so that we can figure out what the best solution is. I don't think we intentionally make these things bad so that only experts, in inverted commas, can figure out the solution. I don't think that's the intention. It's just perhaps these people don't know.
I think it's also a product of the fact that Linux distributions are general. You know, you download this one image for all PCs. You know, you just don't know the mix of hardware that you're going to install it on. And it's unfortunate that your speakers sound like a tin can underwater, but it might be that it only affects users with that particular sound card, and we just don't know that that's an issue, or that we've had to make a compromise so that it doesn't sound like a tin can underwater for 95% of users. It's a very tricky balance to strike. Matthias Stewart emailed us about old versions of Ubuntu.
I run Ubuntu on three machines. 1904 on a 10-year-old MacBook that I use for evening surfing because I'm curious about new features in GNOME, and to have the most recent kernel to make that machine as fast as possible. 1804 LTS on a work laptop because I want maximum stability, and much of the work software is packaged for LTS releases. And 1604 GNOME on my desktop workstation. I would love to upgrade this machine to 1804. The reason I'm not upgrading is one specialized software I need that is only distributed as a deb for 1404 or 1604 with several dependencies. A deb to snap tool would be great.
Okay. Matthias, can you send us a follow-up email with details of that one bit of software? And we can explain to you how you don't need a deb to snap at all, because snapping existing debs is really easy. But if you provide the details, we'll follow up on that with you.
Interesting fact, before Snapcraft existed, there was a tool called deb2snap, actually called deb2snap. It didn't last very long because Snapcraft came along and replaced it.
Paul Waring ranted at us on Twitter at Ubuntu Podcast.
Just heard my HTTPS email read out in a ranty voice. Sorry if it came across that way. Was meant to be private. Heads up!
And Hamish sent us a guide to moving an encrypted install to a new drive, which I believe is a follow-up to your segment where you talked about upgrading your disks last week.
Yes, I will certainly take a look at this. I'm pretty sure this was one of the ones I looked at and didn't work, but I will have another look at it because Samantha needs her hard drives upgrading. So I will take another look at that. Thank you.
And that is the end of the feedback. And that's all for episode 4. How was that then? I still feel like a beginner. I'm not back on this horse yet. No, I don't. Oh, and there's Alexa going off in the background as well. Perfect timing. Well played. Right then, that's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more community news and goings on and events. You can find us in the Ubuntu Podcast Telegram channel. That's ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. And you can send your feedback to show@ubuntupodcast.org. See you all in the next one.